Today at Reader's Corner, an encore presentation with Dr. Jonathan Metzl, author of Dying of Whiteness. I'm Bob Kustra. Welcome to Reader's Corner. In his book, Dying of Whiteness, How the Politics of Racial Resentment is Killing America's Heartland, physician Jonathan Metzl relays the journey he undertook to understand the implications of racial resentment on our public policies in three key states. Interviewing a range of everyday Americans, he explains how racial resentment fueled pro-gun laws in Missouri, resistance to the Affordable Care Act in Tennessee, and cuts to schools and social services in Kansas. He also shows how the cost of these policies are often visited on the very citizens who support them, increasing deaths by gun suicide, falling life expectancies, and rising dropout rates. Jonathan Metzl is the Frederick B. Rentschler II Professor of Sociology and Psychiatry at Vanderbilt University and director of its Center for Medicine, Health, and Society. A prominent expert on gun violence and mental illness, his other books include Prozac on the Couch, Indifference and Identity in Medicine. Jonathan Metzl, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thanks so much. I'm delighted to be here.
I'm going to do something I normally don't do, Jonathan. I'm going to start at the end of the book instead of the beginning, because at the very end of your book, you commented on something that so much relates to what's happened in these last few days. This interview is taking place just days after back-to-back mass shootings. As an expert on mental illness and guns, I'd just like to get your thoughts on claims by the pro-gun politicians and the NRA that this really is a mental illness problem, not a gun issue, nor a white supremacy issue. And at the very end of the book, you actually talked about this and shared with the readers how most Americans look at this, not just the NRA and politicians.
Well, thank you. And again, I'm delighted to be here. In the book, about a third of the book looks at guns and gun policy. I spent a lot of time researching the book, going back to Missouri, where I'm from, and really kind of spending time in very pro-gun communities, and then looking at policies, politicians. And so an important point for me, on one hand, was figuring out just what the roles of guns were in people's everyday lives, times when guns weren't being shot or fired, but just how people lived with guns and thought about them. And then I looked at all of the data and rhetoric and factors like that surrounding them. And so on one hand, I have to say, just before I get to the mental illness story, that I think it was important for me to understand just why people in red states felt so strongly about guns. And that was a huge part of the story. But the flip side was that that guns and gun ownership and resistance to any kind of intervention like a gun law was being fueled, I felt, by politics and advertisements and politicians and news and other factors that basically told people that, you know, they needed to have guns because of, you know, it was very clearly coded as kind of a defense of whiteness against an invasion or restoration or factors like that. And the times that those narratives were the most challenged, I felt, were actually after mass shootings. I mean, even though the book talks about suicide, but after mass shootings, people would kind of have this moment of kind of waking up and saying, gosh, I care about my guns, but what's the story of why somebody, you know, maybe somebody from our community might be taking a gun and killing innocent people? And so there was this narrative that kind of came down from on top that kept saying, it's not the gun. It's the mental illness. It's the mental illness problem. Don't worry about the gun. Don't worry about the gun policy. And in fact, President Trump made a similar claim when he said mental illness pulled the trigger. And I've spent years researching this question, and this is problematic for a couple of reasons. First of all, because on an aggregate level, people with mental illness are far less likely to be the perpetrators of violence than the victims of violence. And so it's a stereotype that plays on this idea that people with mental illness are ticking time bombs, but it's actually factually not true. Illnesses like depression and schizophrenia actually make people less likely to shoot other people rather than more likely. But, you know, it just became this story that everybody told as a way of also deflecting the conversation away from what do we do about guns in America? Because if it was a mental illness problem, then gosh, it couldn't be a gun problem. And so it was pretty powerful to be in those communities and see how, you know, how people wrestled with that narrative. And, you know, ultimately, as I've been arguing in the days since the mass shooting, it became a deflection that didn't really help anybody. It stigmatized people with mental illness. It certainly didn't make communities safer. And, you know, my book's about gun suicide, this failure to have any kind of common conversation about guns ultimately became a risk factor for people who were living in pro-gun communities as well. So I can't say how strongly enough I've come out against that narrative that mental illness pulled the trigger.
Well, let's do go back to the beginning of your journey. You find yourself in a grief support group in Cape Girardeau, Missouri, which I know well as a former St. Louisan. Tell us how this happens and what you learn in this support group.
Sure. So I spent a lot of time just wanting to talk to people in pro-gun communities. And I went all through many southern red states. And I'll just say up front that I've changed a lot of the details about the people and some cases of places. But where that led me, I mean, I went to some NRA meetings. I went to some pro-gun meetings. But for me, the most powerful part of the journey was going to support groups for people who were themselves pro-gun but had lost loved ones, spouses, parents, in some cases children, to either accidental shootings or to gun suicide. And what I found in those groups was, on one hand, just tremendous pain and suffering, but people were also, you know, trying to make sense of this story of how was it that the gun that was supposed to be their protector against invaders ended up costing them a family member or a loved one inside their own house. One of the more painful stories I heard were, you know, parents had lost children as young as 6, 7, 8, 9 to accidental shootings because the guns were readily available to the parents and it turned out to the children. And what I found was when I interviewed people like that, you know, I would ask them, has this story changed your thoughts about guns at all? And people would tell me, you know, the same thing. It's not the gun's fault. And so the depth of commitment to the weapon was very powerful, but people were really struggling again because the narrative they'd always been told was that this was defense against the outsider, but it turned out the danger lived inside their house on their nightstand.
One of the things that impressed me about a section of your book is where you talk about the number of guns that are in the marketplace, in people's homes today, way exceeding what that number was just a few years ago. And you point, I believe, to the role the NRA plays early on. Maybe it was in the 80s. I wonder if you could help us understand what happened at that critical moment that scared the daylights, apparently, out of a lot of people that felt they had to have a gun in their house.
Well, starting right now first, I mean, of course, you know, we have 1.25 guns for every person in the country on an aggregate level. The United States has about 4.5% of the world's population, but we own about 50% of the world's civilian-owned firearms. So we have a civilian arsenal, really, in this country, and the numbers are quite staggering. This wasn't always the case. I mean, you probably remember, and I remember growing up in Missouri, the NRA was a kind of a hunters association, or they would come to schools and teach safe practices for how to handle guns. And there were laws across the country that on one hand respected the rights of hunters and gun owners, but also, you know, made it hard for people to just go in and pick up a gun, and certainly to have the kind of gun that the military would have. And that all changed really in the 1980s for a couple of reasons. Actually, it started a little bit earlier, which was that the civil rights era of the 1960s created a lot of fear in people about who could particularly have a gun. And so there was a radicalization story in the 1960s where the NRA started to shift from being kind of a hunter's organization slowly to a political organization. But the key things that happened in the 1980s first was, you know, around the Reagan era, really starting to fund politicians to defend the rights, not so much of gun owners, but of gun manufacturers. And that led to what they called a reinterpretation of the Second Amendment. So there was a series of Senate committees at the time that basically changed the idea of why people owned guns in the first place and who could own guns. And this really led to this massive change in just the idea that civilians could own guns and carry them in public at all. And so really this started to happen in the 1980s and really kind of gained steam throughout the 20th and 21st centuries.
You're listening to Reader's Corner. My guest today is Jonathan M. Metzl, author of Dying of Whiteness, How the Politics of Racial Resentment is Killing America's Heartland. You've unearthed some incredible research, some statistics on who really does suffer from gun violence. And I'd like you to address, we'll get to exactly what that is in a moment, but I'd like you to address a New England Journal of Medicine article. I don't want you to necessarily talk about the details of the article, but what role that plays when it comes to the issue of whether or not we allow research on this issue, as we allow research on almost every other issue when it comes to funding, federal funding. But Congress stepped in here and changed things, and I think it's so critical because yours is the only book out there that did this because you took the time to do it, and who knows how many other accounts of gun violence and what's the real cause of it could be out there if it wasn't for the Dickey Amendment. What's that?
Well, so when people ask me now as a gun researcher or other gun researchers, you know, about the big questions, how do we prevent this? How do we stop this? I tell people the first answer should be, we don't know. And the reason we don't know is because we have a shortage of data and databases dating back decades about really gun research. And so the big pressing questions, how do we live in a country where there's a tradition of gun rights, but we want to protect public safety? What are the best safe storage practices? All these other questions that you would think would be research questions, there are huge gaps in our knowledge. And that dates back to the 1990s as a follow-up to the question we were just talking about. When in the 1990s, as the NRA got more powerful, there were a series of publications, a couple of publications in leading medical journals that were actually excellent studies that that talked about the risk of gun ownership versus the benefit. They were quite balanced. But basically what they found on the aggregate was that having a gun in your home increased the chance of having different kinds of shootings in the home. So homes that had gun ownership had higher rates of domestic shootings than homes that didn't. Homes that had guns had higher rates of gun suicide than homes that didn't. Now, that seems to be common sense, right? It would be hard to have a shooting in a house without a gun. So it didn't, at the time, I think, seem to be a particularly controversial series of papers. But the NRA and the politicians it supported used this as a rallying cry to basically say that all gun research was biased, that all research advocated for gun control, even though with these studies, that wasn't the aim or the argument. And they used this to attach a rider to the federal budget in the mid-1990s that basically effectively banned the CDC from funding gun research, from doing large-scale data-driven studies that funded gun research. And over time, this so-called federal ban, it's not a complete ban, but it effectively became that way, spread not just to the CDC, but to the NIH, the NIMH, and other agencies. And really what that meant was that researchers who wanted to study the effects of gun violence or gun safety or gun practices couldn't get the large-scale research grants that academics need to support their research. And over time, what happened was that studies about guns and gun safety and gun violence plummeted to the point where gun injury and death became, I'm pretty sure it was the second least researched and least published topic of American morbidity and mortality. I think it was above a random infectious disease or something like that. But basically, all of the other causes of death, you know, car accidents, heart attacks, hypertension, diabetes, soared past this. And so what happened was we had a situation where gun deaths rose steadily in this country, but our knowledge about how to prevent them plummeted because of this Dickey Amendment.
So let's look at Missouri and some of what you unearthed in your research there. You tell us about the permit to purchase law in Missouri, which was on the books from 1921 to 2007, and then it wasn't. Tell us what happened there, but most importantly then, compare Missouri's gun deaths after 2007 to Connecticut's, which did not repeal its gun laws.
Right. So my focus in the book is gun suicide as a kind of bigger story about gun policy. And I grew up in Missouri. And, you know, before 2007, 2008, as I mentioned before, Missouri had a strong history of gun ownership. People could get guns for hunting, and there were strong traditions of people owning guns and other people who didn't want guns. And there was a process for how you got particularly rifles and handguns in Missouri, which was that you would go to the sheriff's office and get a permit, right? There was a whole permit process you needed in order to purchase a firearm. And I interviewed gun dealers in Missouri and pawn shop owners who told me that that process was not very onerous. It took, several minutes or something like that. But when the NRA and its politicians started to take over state politics in 2007, 2008, one of the first things they did was they overturned this permit to purchase legislation and basically said, you really don't need a permit to get particular kinds of guns. And that was just a small drop in the water for what was coming down the pike in Missouri, which was overturning pretty much all of the state's gun laws. It became increasingly easy to get guns, and you know, they lowered the age to get guns from 21 to 18. You could carry guns in public. Pretty soon, newspapers were calling Missouri the shoot me state, not the show me state. And what I track is what happened to injury and death in the state. And what I found was that even though all the rhetoric was people need guns to defend themselves against invaders, or to use the NRA's terminology, carjackers or gangbangers, very racial terms, it turned out that there were soaring rates of injury and death, but the greatest rates of injury and death that rose were white male suicide. About two-thirds of the death in the state and in the region were from white men who own guns, turning the guns on themselves. And so here was this story where the narrative was we need guns to defend ourselves. But yet again, having a gun in the home became this risk factor that was largely unexamined. And what I do in the book is I compare gun death rates in Missouri to those in Connecticut. And what I show is that states that enacted reasonable common sense legislation did not have the same trends. So Connecticut had relatively tight gun laws, and it didn't stay the same trends, but Missouri, because it became so easy to get a gun, what ultimately happened was it became, for a time, the number one state for gun suicide, for white male gun suicide in the country.
You know, what really shocked me in your book was the fact that you spent some time interviewing white men and showing them the statistics you've just shared with us. And in Tennessee, you interviewed white men and helped them understand that what they were against, Medicaid expansion, the Affordable Care Act, would actually work against their own health. Would you share with our listeners what kind of responses you had from these folks? I'll leave it at that.
The stories about the Affordable Care Act were really stories about people who needed medical attention. So I talked to very chronically ill white and black men across Tennessee. Now, the Affordable Care Act, of course, is this tremendously politicized thing, but at the time, attitudes were still being formed about it. And I think the key finding when I and my research assistants talked to people is that the African-American men we talked to all said, this is a great thing for our country, but a number of the white men that we talked to said, I see that this legislation might help me, but to quote one of our respondents, there's no way I'm signing up for a program that's also going to help Mexicans and welfare queens, is what he said. And so this idea, basically, that people were willing to reject a program that might help them was driven in this fear of a kind of invasion, this idea that basically undeserving immigrants and minorities are going to gain the system and take away resources that might be mine, was a very powerful driving force, and really, I think, led a lot of the resistance to bills like the Affordable Care Act in the South, which ultimately, as we know now, those arguments carried the day. The Affordable Care Act ultimately was relatively blocked in states like Tennessee, and the resultant Medicaid expansion didn't really happen either.
You're listening to Reader's Corner. My guest today is Jonathan M. Metzl, author of Dying of Whiteness, How the Politics of Racial Resentment is Killing America's Heartland. When you compare ethnic groups, including whites, who die by gun suicide, who dominates by how much?
We have about 40,000 gun deaths a year in this country. Two-thirds of those gun deaths are suicide, even though we don't hear much about it in the media. And of those, about 85 to 90% are white Americans, predominantly white men. And so, you know, the irony of this situation, the tragic irony, is that white men are the majority of gun owners in this country, but they're also overwhelmingly the most likely people to die from gun suicide.
And having said that, they're not all white men, and I'd like you to comment on what is basically the last chapter of your book regarding what happened to Becca Campbell in Missouri.
Yeah, so the Becca Campbell became a kind of metaphor for me. The Becca Campbell story was one about what was happening in St. Louis around the time of a lot of racial unrest and protests around the Ferguson shooting. And so the story I tell in the book is about a white woman who got a gun, as she said it, to get ready for Ferguson. And she bought a pistol, and they were driving around the street. Somebody else was driving the car, and she was waving the gun in her hand. And she said, "Let's get ready for some protest." And, you know, was making this kind of desperado kind of move. And ultimately, the gun, she put it up to her head by accident. The car got into a fender bender, and she ended up shooting herself in the head. And so, tragic, tragic story of a woman who died needlessly by what was more than likely an accidental shooting, not a suicide. But it became a metaphor for the bigger story I was trying to tell in the book about how these guns become symbols of what we do to, as she put it, deal with racial unrest. But ultimately, white America, in many cases, by not enacting smarter policies or not looking at race more closely, ends up pointing the gun at itself.
Racism is a central element addressed in your book, and you're quick to point out that most of the people you spoke to showed no overt racism. Help us understand how that works, and do you have any ideas on what we do about that?
Yeah, so in the book, I make quite clear that I'm not really totally talking about people's individual racism, and I don't talk about whiteness as itself a biological category or even so much an identity category. What I talk about is the ways that racial resentment becomes embedded into public policies and social policies, and the ways that those policies end up being bad for everyone, including white Americans. And so the story I tell in the book really isn't about people's individual racism, even though there are plenty of examples of it, but many other people were not racist. The story I tell was about what happens to a particular state or a particular country when a particular kind of white nationalist politics that's based in anti-immigrant, anti-government, pro-gun, when those become the kind of driving forces for your politics, we end up enacting policies that, for example, block healthcare reform or allow the easy access to guns, or in another chapter, block funding for education. And ultimately, what I show is that these policies end up making the lives of everyone, including working class white people, harder, sicker, and in many instances, shorter.
You also interviewed African-American men. What did you learn in those interviews?
Those were remarkable interviews. We did interviews with African-American men, largely around the Affordable Care Act. Now, this was the era of President Obama, and so they were probably, many of them, inclined to support what he was doing anyway. But we talked to them about what it meant to have health insurance. A lot of these men were chronically ill as well, and we would just say, you know, what's the benefit of having a bill like the Affordable Care Act? And almost to a person, they didn't give us answers that were like, it would be good for me or it would be good for black men. What they kept saying was, this would be good for everybody. This would be good for the entire country. We should all have health insurance and we should all have a common social safety net. And so this notion, and that's, if you think about it, that's how health insurance works. But this notion that health insurance and the Affordable Care Act would help everybody was a very common refrain. And it was, in a way, probably one of the more positive points of the book. We're speaking to these men who basically were saying, it's not just about me, it's not just about my group. And so there was this assumption, a very communal assumption and a larger picture of America that was not just about our own group or our own tribe, but about everyone. Mm-hmm.
But back to the title of your book, Dying of Whiteness, you talk about an investment in a sense of whiteness. Maybe we could kind of sum this up by having you explain just just what you mean by that, what you discovered, what is so contrary about where these folks have wound up in their beliefs when in fact they're working against them.
Right. So I wasn't studying extreme examples in my book. I didn't talk to, you know, white nationalist extremists. I really tried to talk to everyday people. And many people who were brave and struggling to survive and really just trying to make it on a day-to-day level and take care of themselves and their families. But what I found was these narratives were so powerful, this idea that whiteness was under attack from invaders, that undeserving immigrants were gaming the system, or minorities were pouring across the borders. And so the sense was basically that what they needed to defend was their position in a social hierarchy, this idea that whiteness was something that was defined in opposition to immigrants and minorities, as opposed to being a bigger story about America. And really the story I tell in the book is how that narrative of whiteness becomes a driving force that leads people into supporting politics that are not just bad for immigrants and minorities, which they clearly are, but also for themselves.
So I wonder, did you get any pushback from your book? I mean, I can't – it's so well documented and your research is so strong. I can't imagine how anybody could respond to this other than say, you got me. I know that's not what they will say, but what have you heard?
We don't live in a fact-driven era. I mean, really, I try to be as objective as I can, although my opinions are clearly present in my own responses throughout the book. But I really tried hard to understand people and not to pathologize them, and really just to show the data-driven effects of the policies that they were supporting. You know, we live in an era of fake news, and any fact can be undermined by a tweet in about 2 seconds. And so it's not the most fact-driven era. But I have had some pretty remarkable conversations since the book came out, both with people I've interviewed, and I've been back in touch with a lot of my research subjects, and with people more broadly. And I feel like one of the more encouraging parts for me have been conversations with people who I wouldn't have thought I would have been able to talk to before about just how do we work our way out of this. So I'm in ongoing conversation with people on all sides of the gun debate, for example, people who care about education and healthcare. And so as much as I can, I argue for a kind of common dialogue. Now, part of that story is not just about everyday people. What I also gained appreciation for in writing this book was how when you talk to people on the ground, they're far less extreme very often, or the ones who spoke with me, than you might think they would be from Twitter, for example, or from the news. And so I did think a lot and write some in the book about how, you know, these everyday conversations are often drowned out by factors that polarize us in this country, like Twitter and news and the president. And so in a way, it's also a narrative of frustration that I wish I could have more conversations like the one I do in my book and since it's come out.
Well, I can't recommend it more highly. I think it's one of the clearly one of the best books we've used here at Reader's Corner this year. And I urge anyone, if you haven't purchased one book this year, get out there and get Dying of Whiteness, How the Politics of Racial Resentment is Killing America's Heartland by Jonathan M. Metzl. Jonathan, thank you so much for joining me today. Again, a psychiatrist, a professor of psychiatry at Vanderbilt University. You've done an excellent job, and we look forward to having you back when your paperback edition comes out, and we'll spend more time talking about what you learned in Tennessee on health care and Kansas regarding school policy. Thanks
thank
for
you
being
so
here.
Much. It's been my honor.
Appreciate it. Jonathan Metzl, thank you for joining us today at Reader's Corner. Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio News. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.